position number 11952, rule 3.
Mr. Rozelle, Reel 3. I think you were telling me about an incident at Arras when a German was given to you to send back.
Yes, well, I told him that nobody can take a German, a single German back. So I told him to go back, you know, and he looked back, and all we could see was line after line of our troops coming up with the dawn light glistening on their bayonets, and it really looked, I could understand why he was frightened looking back, and he had to go through there. So suddenly away he went, zigzagging like a rabbit. Well, my instinct was to draw a bead, and I had a bead on his shoulders. I didn't pull the trigger, and these policemen that I've been going to France with, you know, I told you about, they said that was Hitler. You're responsible for the Second World War. You let Hitler go. I was just pulling my leg, of course. But I let him go. He got back to his own lines. I went a dip in the ground anyway. The idea was I couldn't shoot him in the back. He was running for his life and zigzagging. And I just couldn't. That's it. So perhaps I wasn't a good sniper.
How far could you actually shoot accurately with your sniper's
300
rifle?
Yards with a telescopic sight, yes. Yes.
And you wouldn't have shot at a target further than that, then?
No. Well, it's stupid to do so, because if you don't want to let them know that you're firing, that you're there, you want to make sure of a perfect shot, don't you? And if you fired at 600 yards, say, I mean, our Lee Enfields were supposed, they reckoned that before it was a spent shot, they would fire about 2 miles. But of course, the trajectory is dropping naturally. Well, you know, on the Lee Enfield, you've got the sight you can raise. You can tell how much you've got an angle, something like that, if you're at 1,000 yards or
about 45 degrees, then.
Yes, yes.
How did you get on with your sniping officer? What sort of chap was he?
Darn good. And I guess one thing is a gap in my memory. I can't remember his name, but he was a Jew. And he was very keen, and he looked after us like his family, you know. And he obviously wasn't hard up, because when we got out the trenches, he used to give our cook money to go and see if he could buy chickens or rabbits or wine or anything, you know, so we were well fed. And he always did that. But on the Somme, he got smashed up, and I never heard from him again. And I made inquiries, and I got nothing from it, you know. But somebody told me that his elbow was smashed, and that he was shot in the body. They saw him in a shell hole, and that's all I know. But I've never been able to remember his name. And of course, after the Somme, our snipers were never formed again. We were smashed up. And when I think the waste of on a battlefield is, we had telescopes, telescopic sights, rangefinders, Latte night sights, equipment galore, and that was all left on the battlefield, because none of those snipers came out from Oak Villas on the Somme, just myself.
This officer, was he a Londoner? Do you know?
I don't know.
I never had
I always chatted with him normally, but nothing intimate. I didn't know anything about his, where he came from, or his family, or anything.
Do you remember if he was a regular, or whether he was?
No, he was. I understood he was in law. Whether he was a lawyer or just to do with the law, or a barrister, or what, I don't know.
And he joined up for the duration of the war?
Yes, just for the duration. And there's another thing, going back, Oh, no, I'll come to it later. That's when I went back to France the second time. So, only we had another officer who was not with the snipers, but we were going up a draft to our regiment from Etap. We'd been sent back to Etap. And he decided we'd all go out, just the draft, probably about 12 men and himself. And we went out to the bombing range, and we all threw a Mills bomb. Well, I'd thrown dozens by that time, you know. This is the second time going up. But anyway, we all threw one, and one didn't go off. And he did something that we'd been told never to do. We waited and waited, and he went out to pick it up. Killed him. So our draft officer, we went without him. And he was just on the draft a couple of days after we went back to France. Remember that, I didn't know his name either. There's another young officer I sat with all night. He was my age, 19. First time in the trenches. And he told me all about his family, his schooling, and he'd left university. He said, you know, you're a veteran, which I was, not in years, but... And he said, I can come with you, can't I? I said, oh, yes, okay, when we go over the top. Do you know, I didn't know him. I can't remember his name now. He's our new platoon officer, young second lieutenant. So we went, climbed up the trench. We'd probably gone about 6 yards when he went down, because you can't stop, but I stopped long enough to see that he'd been shot in the head and
the back of
his head was out there. Yeah. He'd never seen that affected me. He'd never seen a German, and he told me all about his family. I thought of his family, and I thought then, what a waste, young lad like that. That things like that affect you. And I remember I was talking to our captain. He was writing to his family, you see, and I said I didn't know their family, but I spent the whole evening, the whole night with him. We sat in the bottom of his trench. I hadn't got any cigs, he had. I was smoking his cigarettes, and I told him. So he mentioned the fact that I'd gone with him, and I'd seen that he was shot, you know, that there was no pain or anything. He didn't know anything about it. He just
died immediately.
Yeah, yeah.
Did you ever contemplate the risks when you were undergoing training in England? Did you ever think about it?
No, I don't think so. We were told about it, you know, you've got to take notes of all these things, otherwise you'll most likely end up dead and all that sort of thing. This is the idea of the training and so on. But I don't think we took it seriously. You always thought that it was happened to someone. In fact, it's only these last few years, when I'm in my 90s, that I've thought about those sort of things. Because in between, when I came home and got married young and all that, I was earning a living and worrying about that more than anything else.
You're
and
too busy to worry
about
that.
Yes. But
so you at Aldershot, you were doing more of the same basic tactical training,
yes.
And you were sniping,
yes,
and so on,
and longer route marches and 2 or 3 day manoeuvres without coming back to camp, you know, and so on. In fact, hard training, you know.
What sort of length of route march did you work up to then?
Well, as I said, 3 or 4 hours. You could hardly tell. You'd be out for 2 or 3 days and you'd move to this place and you'd get orders to move some other place. And so I couldn't have any record, really, but I know that the time we got back after one of those sessions, we were pretty tired, you know.
When you did a route march, did you sing?
Yes, oh yes, sing, yes. And when we got our colonel, because we got our colonel, I think he came to us about Sandlin or Shorncliffe. He used to ask you to sing, you know, to come out and say, sing up, sing up. And he was a... Everybody, you know, they talk about they'd do anything for a colonel. Well, we had one like that. They really adored him, you know. He was a regular. He'd been on Northwest Frontier. I remember he was a good-looking fellow, 6 foot odd, grey hair over his temples. But he was a lovely fellow. And when we got out there, you know, he'd come along the trench and say, "Can I look over here?" If you said yes, he'd look over, you know. And we'd say, "No, you get your head shot off if you do," you know, and so on. But he was always like that, a good fellow. And in England, when we were at Sandling, he did come to Sandling, we used to parade in the morning, no equipment, trousers and your socks, a loose dress, you know, and we'd double right down the slope, right onto the front at Hythe, and we did probably about a mile and a half to begin with. And he used to run with us, you know. And in the end, we were doing about 3 miles every morning, 3 mile double. And any man who dropped out would get 6 days CB. But nobody dropped out, you know. But when we got to the end of it, going into camp, he would double mark time while the battalion went by. He'd say, "That's right, on your toes, B Company, you know. Heads up, A Company," and so on. He did everything you did, you see. And when we went to the swimming pool, or going back, we used to go to a swimming pool somewhere around there, an open-air swimming pool, and it was icy cold. I believe it was a spring fed or something, round forget the name. He used to dive in with us, just the same, and we had no swimming costumes or anything, you know. Just went there, all men, of course. And
just dive in naked.
Yeah, and he did everything with us, and yet he must have been in his 50s, 50, 55, I should think. And he was just the same, and he got killed like that, walking over the top. Round a bit, like that, going over the top, machine guns. Annesley, Lieutenant Colonel Annesley, lovely boy. And we always knew when we were in France if we were going over the top, because if possible they would arrange a concert for us in a barn or even in the open air in the good weather and get people to sing. We had various people who'd done that sort of thing in civil life, you know. And if we were going over the top, at least we thought it was that, he sang to us. And the lads used to say, "We're for it next time, Ed," you know. He's singing, yeah.
What sort of songs did you sing?
Marching songs, of course. But I remember one of his songs, he sang it a couple of times at different concerts, was, "And when I tell them how wonderful you are, they'll never believe me. That was, and they used to cheer that everything for him, you know. Good little thing.
Do you remember any other officers who stood out?
Yes, Featherston Hoare, Feathers they called him. The adjutant, can't think of his name, he came to us at Colchester. He was a civilian, joined for the war. He was a barrister or a solicitor or something. And they were all killed on the same day. And this Featherston Hoare, he had a terrific bad temper, you know, and we had a regimental sergeant major born in the army, very, very smart. In fact, they called him Flash Harry. He was one of the youngest regimental sergeant majors in the army, I believe. And I remember at one of the places, either Aldershot or Shorncliffe, he was taking the officers drilling the battalion, you see. And of course he was saying to them, you know, "Not like that, sir. Cut your executive word sharp," you know. And I could see this Feathers getting worked up. He was, and meanwhile he'd probably got the battalion walking away, you know. And regiment would say, "Well, give him an order, sir, otherwise I'll be out of sight, you know, and all this. And Phyllis got that excited, you know, but bad-tempered rather. And as I told you, some of them were dressed in blue. And we hadn't khaki for everybody. And in the end, and he also said to him, and correct your men, doesn't matter whether they're moving or not, he said, tell them to keep still. And so, of course, you could see out in front of the battalion, he was getting the class right. And suddenly, he topped his voice. What's the matter with that so-and-so in blue? Effa, you know. And at the top of his voice, that was Phyllis at all. He belonged to an aristocratic family, so I understand. But he was killed, and he was killed because of his temper, because we were waiting to go over at Overlis, and the word came along, pass the word along, Captain Phyllis and all is wounded, he's going back. So we pass it along, you see. Little after, pass the word along, Captain Phyllis and all is not going back. We only about 2 or 3 minutes for zero, you see, over. So he went over, but apparently those who were near him said he was shot through the neck, and he said he was going back, and then he started swearing, no, I'm not going to get away with this, you know, the so-and-so, and he went over the top, he was killed. He could have gone back. So that was Phillison Hall, and I saw his name on the people without known graves on one of the memorials there. Phyllison Hall, Captain Phyllison Hall, yeah. And Larlam, platoon officer I like very much, he gave me a compass, I've still got it, a pocket compass, I don't know why. He suddenly said, we were standing talking in the trench one night, and he said, pull it out of his pocket. He said, yeah, oh, Corporal, you have that. I said, well, you'll probably want it, won't you? No, he said, you keep it, you keep it. And I've often wondered about that. He was killed the next day. Whether he wanted, whether he knew, you don't know, do you? Larlam, his name. And in my paybook I've got, when we first went to France, they put down where you were, Armentier, Le Bizet, and so on, you know. And then it was ordered that they shouldn't do that. It's got to be in the field, because if you were captured, it was a diary of where you'd been. But of course it was signed by various officers, and I got several officers there that I was very fond of. Alan, he was a Quaker, and they say that he was forsaken by his family when he joined up, because they don't believe in it. Well, he was blown to pieces at Lewes, and he was a brave fellow. Remember, walking along the trench, foolhardy, really, you know. And in the morning, he walked along the trench at Lewes there. How are you, chaps? You Brighton, you know, and all this sort of thing. He was killed there. I remember a big, we used to call them coal boxes. What size shell they were, I don't know. Called terrific things. When they burst, they blew everything down, you know, trench and everything. And there were apparently four of them in this trench. Three men and this Alan, when one dropped right in there. And I had the horrible job getting a group of men to shovel them all into a blanket, really, you know, and pull it away to a deserted part of the trench so we could bury it under cover of darkness at the back. You see, we used to bury anybody out at night in the shell holes. But he was killed like that. He wouldn't know anything about it. That was Alan. Chell. He was a company officer, and we were in one part of the line where you couldn't go, you couldn't dig trenches, it came to water about 2 feet down, so we had what we called grouse butts. They were really built up with sandbags and whatnot. Well, you can quite see if a shell hit one of those, you're all exposed. Well, he was exposed and buried in the shell hole, you know, and we got him out, and he was wounded in the leg, in the thigh mostly. Well, we knew nothing about first aid in those days. Probably it was his femoral artery or something, you see. Well, you can't let that pump long, can you? And of course we thought he's not too bad. He's okay. Word came back, he died. That was Chell. I got his name in my pay book. So, the fortune of war.
Did you have any officers who you didn't like?
No, I don't think so. I didn't like... he wasn't an officer. I mean, I didn't like Flash Harry very much. He was a... When I came back, after I'd been wounded, I was in England 7 months. I came back to France and was sent back to my own battalion. Well, I wanted to come back to my own battalion. And the battalion was in the line, but the headquarters in a village just behind. And of course the regimental always stayed when they went in the line. They always stayed with the transport. And the same clerk was in the office, the company clerk, in England, because he would stay behind, so he hadn't been killed or wounded, you see. And of course he knew me, you see. Oh, hello, are you back again, so-and-so? He said, the regimental's in the next door, I'll tell him you're back. And he went in there and he said, oh, Corporal Rozelle's come back, you know. Do you want to see him? Well, the so-and-so, so-and-so, hell do I want to see him for? That was him, you see. Not that it mattered, but that was Flash Harry.
What do you think were the qualities that made a man into a good officer? What did you look for in an officer?
Well, one that never showed, although everybody was scared, he never showed he was scared, and he was always able to, if you were in a tight position, to make some decision, you know. We'll do this, we'll not just stand and wonder. That sort of thing, I think. And on top of that, it was a great leveller, of course. I mean, if a man was a harsh man out and that, I noticed that in the line, I mean, the projectiles and the bullets didn't differentiate between any class, did they? They just hit anybody. And it made for a great leveller. And once you'd been in the line several times, you knew the ones that were genuine, that weren't scared, and so on and so forth. But of course, I must say, everybody was scared sometimes. Must have been.
Did you find that once you'd been in the line, relationships became less formal?
Yes, yes, that's what I say, it was a great leveller. Even with those first ones that went out, who were really aristocrats and in the before the war army, you see. But in several cases I found they had feet of clay, because we had one officer, Captain Charles, that we admired. Good looking chap. Used to wear his cap like this, you know, and
was an angle.
Dark, and we all liked him. And yet when we got to the front, we'd only been in the line about 3 months, and he was going on leave. He told his matman, I won't be back. Hell with this. And having influence, and he was an honourable or something, he became port officer for Boulogne for the rest of the war. And we had another one who did exactly the same, because they were able to. I mean, they could resign or go home if they wanted to, you see, but anybody else couldn't do that. You shut the door if you tried it.
Did you have any cases of soldiers suffering from what they called neurasthenia, from shell shock?
Well, we had, of course. They called it shell shock, but in the line they called it cowardice. I mean, the only one I ever saw was at Lewes. It was our first baptism of. We'd had casualties before, but not in the numbers we got there. It was our first real baptism of the tough stuff, you know. And we had one fella drop on the bottom of the trench and kick his heels and yell, you know, we're going over the top, we're going over the top, and so on. He lost his head, you see. And of course, most of the fellas were saying, what's the matter with him then, you know? Well, it was bad for the rest of them. Well, what became of him, I never knew. But we had several cases. We were lined up behind the lines to hear that somebody had been shot at dawn. They used to line us up now and again to make sure, because there were over 300 shot at dawn, you know, for cowardice, they call it. Well, mostly it was somebody under a terrific bombardment. They'd left the trenches. Well, once they got behind the line, they were lost, and there were military police behind. They didn't go up the line. They were always at the back, you see. They'd soon pick him up. And, of course, his crime was that he'd left the trenches, left the face of the enemy, and deserted and whatnot. And he was sentenced to death, and the sentence was duly carried out. That's where we were told. I've got a photograph of one gravestone in France. Their son was shot at dawn. They knew it, and they insisted that they were going to put their own message on the gravestone. It's on there, you see, because they knew that when you're under an intense bombardment, you can get to the stage where, well, they call it battle fatigue now.
How did you cope with it yourself?
Well, I used to get on as low as I could to try and creep into the earth, and I knew that if you hoped it didn't drop on you, that's all. Then when it was over, that was that, you know, because it didn't go on forever. So many hours, sometimes, intense bombardment, you couldn't do anything about it. But that's what I say. I had a charmed life. I must have had a charmed life.
Did you know of the existence of conscientious objectors?
Yes, I knew about them. I never met any of them, but I knew about them because my brother, my oldest brother, had a friend who was a conscientious objector. And he was put in prison and whatnot, and that's how I knew about it. But they didn't make a lot of it public. We heard about it, that there were conscientious objectors, and of course in those days most people sort of derided them and thought they were cowards and all that sort of thing. But since I've grown up, I think that's, well, can be questioned, I suppose.
What did you think of them at the time?
Well, at the time we thought like the others, you know. We thought, what the hell's the matter with them, you know, because they used to ask them questions. So we were told, you know, if a German was going to rape your sister, what would you do? And they said, oh, I couldn't kill, you see. And so on. But I know some of them must have been very courageous, because I understand they wouldn't wear the uniform, so they went about naked in the barracks or wherever they were. But this friend of my brother's, he was put in prison.
We've been getting ahead of ourselves a bit.
We are, aren't we? Yeah.
In the story, you'd got to Aldershot and you'd been training.
Yeah, it's not Aldershot on there, is it? We're talking about. God, Lord. It's out there.
So you were at Aldershot, and was Aldershot the last place you did training before going to France?
Yes, we went from the railway station in Aldershot down to Folkestone and across. And the first night we climbed up the hill from Boulogne, and there were tents up there, and we were all sort of preparing to spend the night when I was called out, and I was on guard that night. So I didn't get any sleep that night, and in the morning there were a lot of girls selling things, cakes and things, and I remember Flash Harry came along, played hell with me. What are you doing? Shh, send them all away, get them out of it, you know. Well, when we went to the girls, you know, said Ali, they sat on the floor, so we let them sit there. The RSM had gone. I remember that. Little things.
What was your voyage across the Channel like? Do you remember anything about that?
It was pretty pretty smooth. We went... it was evening time when we went, and dark by the time we landed. And but there was one other time. Anyway, I'm digressing if I tell you about that. But that was when I came back off leave, and we were in the hotels on along the front at Folkestone, and waiting for the boat. And then they said, we may not go tonight, it's too rough, and so on. Well, we didn't mind, it's another night in England, you know. But in the end, yes, we're going, and we went. And we got on board. As soon as we got out of the harbour, we knew it was rough, so they ordered everybody off the deck down below. Well, it was pretty crowded down below, and I remember I got in the saloon. There were brigadiers and nurses and all sorts, and it was pretty crowded, you know. And we'd only been there a short time when the stewards came round and dished out enamel bowls, you know. And after a bit, people began to go, try to be dignified, but in the end, it was like a battlefield. I remember everybody was seasick. And I remember I wanted to go out on deck. I thought, if I can go somewhere, fresh air.